The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There are a number of ISIS detention centers as well as displacement camps in northeast Syria. Already there were issues with the safety and security and stability of those camps and detention sites prior to the pandemic. The pandemic simply, I think, deepened and heightened those concerns, added a layer of agitation to those both in the prisons and in the displacement camps. And we've seen, for example, the same prison in Hasakeh province in northeastern Syria have rioting take place amongst the prisoners, not once but twice. So that's another area that one needs to watch, particularly since ISIS has placed a premium on calling for prison breaks as a way of boosting its recruitment.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 13th, 2020. You've heard a lot about COVID-19 and its effects in the United States, in China and East Asia, in Europe, and even in Brazil. But what about the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa? The virus is hitting these regions hard with profound political and national security consequences. To discuss it all, we brought into the Virtual Jungle Studio an all-star panel of regional experts. First, Mona Yacoubian. She is a senior advisor on Syria, the Middle East, and North Africa at the United States Institute of Peace. Second, Nilanthi Samaranayake. She is the director of the Strategy and Policy Analysis Program at CNA, with expertise on Indian Ocean and South Asia security. Finally, Judd Devermont. He is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a former National Intelligence Officer for Africa. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 13th, COVID-19 and its national security implications in the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa. Mona, let's start with Iran and then the wider Middle East in terms of how COVID arrived and how it spread this spring. How did it first affect the Levant and the wider Middle East?
So Iran was the first country in the Middle East to experience COVID, and it was quite early. It was as early as mid-February that there were actual reports of it. It started in the religious city of Qom, but then very quickly spread throughout the country. It was notable that a number of senior Iranian officials contracted the disease. There was one memorable anecdote when I think it was the deputy health minister who was giving a press conference just sweating profusely. And was noting, no, this has been stabilized, there really is no outbreak, and the next day it's reported that he's come down with COVID. And so Iran was really one of the earliest ones, and it remains the regional epicenter of the pandemic. Other countries that are now experiencing more significant outbreaks are Iraq, some of the Gulf countries, and Egypt.
Now, the attention that was given, at least in most of the international press, was really to the Iranian government. There wasn't as much attention to the spread among the population in Iran, and even less so to population spread in the other countries. But did it follow a similar pattern to much of the rest of the world, where everybody was focused on flights coming in from China, and then eventually the flights coming in from Europe and other locations got attention?
Well, I think it was absolutely the Islamic Republic's ties to China that were fingered initially. But we should also note that the government really downplayed the pandemic, attempted to hide the true extent of it. There are still questions about how extensive the testing was, but there were videos and other things coming out on Twitter and other social media platforms where it became very clear that the country was fairly quickly overwhelmed. And I should note, they did then respond, but with some lockdown measures, gradual ones through, you know, April and May, and then started to reopen in June. And now they're in the midst of essentially a second surge that has seen, including in the last few days, the largest single number of deaths in one day. And Iran is in the top 10 list for numbers of infections of right. COVID, not a top 10 list you want to be on, right between Italy and Spain.
Right. Nilanthe, let's turn to you. How about South Asia? How did COVID arrive and what was it like in that first month or two?
Sure. India and Pakistan, for their part, they really acted early in terms of imposing restrictions, the lockdowns, suspending air travel, bus travel. But I think one of the criticisms was that it was implemented quite harshly. So there were concerns from the outset about food insecurity, just access to basic staples, migrant workers in India who needed to walk for hundreds of miles to return to their villages due to the restrictions on movement. So it was difficult for them. But Bangladesh is an interesting case because they saw returning migrant workers. So essentially in Bangladesh, a lot of citizens will go abroad to work, especially in the Middle East, and then they will send remittances home. So it's mm-hmm. really a top contributor to the national economy. So these workers were coming home from the Middle East, from Europe, and they weren't really quarantining. So it was a different experience than India and Pakistan. And then they're descending on Dhaka, which is the most densely populated city in the world. And then they're returning to their homes and their villages. So that's how the virus has been spreading in Bangladesh. They're having a difficult time in terms of needing more hospital beds and ventilators. And Bangladesh is expecting a peak in September, Pakistan in the late summer. And then just this week, India surpassed Russia on the Johns Hopkins University tracker. So it's right now after the US and Brazil in terms of confirmed cases. So it's the region's going through a very difficult time right now.
Absolutely. Judd, when and where did Africa get this coronavirus first, and which governments reacted best and worst early on?
I always like the president of Kenya's statement about this. He said, this is a crisis that was not created on the African continent. So in sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria's first in late February, and takes all the way till mid-May for all 49 countries to have their first index cases. And it's a really varied case. Only one case in sub-Saharan Africa, Somalia, actually has a China nexus. The majority of them actually reflect colonial ties. So you see a number of countries that are Anglophone having UK connections, French with Francophone countries, and then a number of countries that have been infected by index cases from Italy, given the early numbers that Italy had. Right. It was pretty slow at first. It took 98 days for the region to reach just 100,000 cases. And so it had the lowest caseload globally. But now things are picking up. 18 days to get to 200,000. And now we're just reached the 500,000 mark.
Well, let me ask you, Judd, how much of that is due to under-testing that we've heard about across Africa?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different hypotheses on why the caseload has been low. And the death rate is actually really low. It's about 12,000 deaths so far. Some people point to sort of the young population age, median's about 19. Some talk about the lockdowns, and I can talk a little more about how swiftly those were implemented. But yes, under-testing is a big challenge on the continent. They're largely just testing in cities. A Reuters report that came out earlier this week said 4,000 tests per million, which, you know, compares very poorly to what the testing levels are in, say, Europe. South Africa, though, I should point out, is actually not bad when it comes to testing. It's the 19th globally in terms of the number of tests or portion of population tested.
Okay. Well, let's dig into the political and social consequences of COVID-19. These obviously will be profound, and in some places, they already are dramatic. Mona, talk with us a bit about these dynamics in the Middle East and where they have been the most consequential.
So I think in many ways, it's going to be COVID's second and third order effects that are probably going to be the most consequential for the region. We're going to see, we're starting to already see it reverberate in ways that are quite significant. And I would note in particular, it's really the economic fallout from COVID, from the shutdown measures that have been put in place that are really poised to impact the region in a significant way. The oil market, for example, witnessed a collapse in price in April. It has since somewhat recovered, but not entirely. And that's given sort of a double whammy impact, if you will, on, in particular, fragile oil-producing countries like Iraq, which depend on oil for 90% of the budget. But I think in many ways, perhaps, in some ways, the poster child for how dramatic and significant COVID's second-order impacts can be is Lebanon. And there, there was already, the country was contending with a very serious debt crisis that started back in October of 2019. Mm-hmm. And the shutdown measures that Lebanon was forced to take as a result of mitigating the effects of the pandemic essentially accelerated and I would say deepened the impact of that debt crisis, so much so that we're now witnessing Lebanon essentially in a free fall and in a very scary way, sort of hurtling toward a failed state.
Mona, let me pause you there. I've seen some reports out of Lebanon that a significant number of people are fleeing. That is, they're leaving, trying to go to Europe and other locations, which is not an easy thing to do during an era of quarantines and lockdowns. How is this affecting Lebanese society now and the prospects for a reconstruction or at least some kind of recovery in the years to come?
Well, again, until they get a handle on the actual debt crisis, and the government has been very, very remiss, sort of AWOL, quite frankly, in terms of negotiating and putting forth a package for the IMF. And so I think the people leaving, we're perhaps starting to see the beginnings of that. But really what's more concerning is the devastating effects on many of those who won't be able to leave. So this is a country that is now being plunged into poverty. It's estimated that 50% of the population and perhaps more is living below the poverty level. There's concerns about hunger. I mean, this is, was a middle income country. And now there are worries about famine, hunger, fuel shortages, unemployment, all of the above. It's basically Venezuela, on the Mediterranean without the oil and with, I would say, significant geostrategic implications for the U.S.
And I would think we couldn't get much more depressing than that, but I'm going to give it a try because another country in the region that did not have the benefits that Lebanon had was Yemen, which was already in a humanitarian catastrophe of epic proportions before COVID. Now, there was a suspension of the ongoing conflict in Yemen for a while as COVID started, but it has come back. What are the prospects for any kind of political recovery in Yemen in the near future?
Unfortunately, I think the prospects are quite dim. And as you rightly point out, this was a country that was already suffering perhaps the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world prior to COVID. We're seeing the healthcare system collapse as COVID has made its way in. And really no clear prospects for any near-term political settlement to the mm-hmm. conflict there. So no, I think, unfortunately, I think Yemen is another place that's very, very worrying.
Nilanthi, let's turn to you. How are the consequences of the coronavirus playing out in India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Pakistan, in the whole region? Where is it the most compelling for you as an analyst to see how political opponents and or extremists are taking advantage of the situation?
Absolutely. I want to echo Mona's point about the economic costs, because you are seeing that across the South Asian countries. India and Pakistan, even though they were early in imposing restrictions, the lockdowns were, they caused such adverse economic impacts that they were essentially unsustainable. So they needed to lift those restrictions. And now we're seeing the even greater transmission of the virus in those countries. In Bangladesh, we are seeing significant economic impacts. This country is really considered a success story. They're expected before COVID to leave the category of lesser developed countries, LDCs. But now, due to the COVID crisis, their garment industry, which has really fueled their economic growth over the past several years, it's been hurt. Their exports are really a top contributor of income for the country, but they've had many orders from overseas canceled or postponed. And so you're seeing increased unemployment and increased poverty in Bangladesh. And it's a in addition to not only decreased exports for Bangladesh for their garments, you're also seeing decreased remittances because the workers who will leave the country and work in the Middle East and just make a lot more money there, they're no longer being able to send back home remittances, which are the number two contributor to Bangladesh's economy. Wow. So it's been very difficult there. Sri Lanka, you mentioned, also has seen a decrease in their exports and also a decrease in tourism, as has Maldives. So both Sri Lanka and Maldives, they're tropical island countries. They rely a lot on tourism to fuel their economies. And they've seen significant economic impacts, decreases. Most of their tourists come from Europe. And also Sri Lanka and Maldives were already very heavily indebted and had significant problems economically even before COVID. So since COVID, it's only exacerbated those problems. And even within the past week, the World Bank downgraded Sri Lanka. It had actually been upgraded to an upper middle income economy by the World Bank, but they've been downgraded back down to lower middle income economy. So there have been significant impacts on these countries. So in terms of politics, Sri Lanka, they're going to have their elections for parliament early next month. So that will be an interesting first test case in South Asia to see if COVID is having any impact politically. And in terms of India, Prime Minister Modi has been pretty strong, I would say in large part due to the India-China border issues that they've been seeing. So that's really helped sort of firm his standing as a national security leader. So he was pretty strong even before COVID. Elsewhere, Pakistan, Imran Khan, the prime minister, he was criticized. He referred to COVID as being like the flu. He got a lot of flack for that. And then in Nepal, the Prime Minister and his team of advisors, they've been accused of receiving kickbacks. So his grasp on leadership right now, it's seen as really called into question. So there's the potential for a lot of political impacts, reverberations from COVID in South Asia.
Does it look like any of the governments in the region are going to suffer a dramatic political backlash because of their handling of COVID?
You know, in Bangladesh, the leader has a tight grip on power. There's a lot of suspicion in terms of the estimates, the official estimates of COVID cases, but she has such a tight grip on power and really just a lack of an opposition or a viable opposition that nothing will probably happen to her. As I mentioned, Modi is pretty strong in India. I would say in Nepal is probably where the leadership, there's the most question about their ability to maintain power. Mm-hmm. And Sri Lanka, we'll see if there's any impact on the government there in terms of the parliamentary elections early next month. And the leadership has been in office, the presidential leadership has been in office for under a year. So that'll be really the first test case in South Asia.
Judd, we just heard about the impact of corruption in at least one case in South Asia. And this appears to be something that's playing out in Africa, as you've covered on your Into Africa podcast. Nigeria, Uganda, Zimbabwe, Kenya, South Africa, and especially Zambia, where a senior government official was fired for graft related to COVID-19. How is the issue of corruption playing politically in the major countries of Africa, and how is it feeding into wider issues of governance?
Yeah, you know, it's when you have a situation where lots of money is pouring into a country to respond to this, health crisis, economic crisis, and you don't have good checks or transparency, you open yourself up to corruption. And so, you know, as you suggested, David, there's been a number of countries that we know of the corruption, most of them being in health ministries. And I suspect there'll be more, especially for countries that don't have accountability. You know, the good contrast is in South Africa, where there are some questions about certain ministers and corruption, mm-hmm. and they're being called to task in parliament. But stepping back, you know, this is really about, in my mind, a huge political challenge for these regions. COVID-19 poses really three tests for African leaders. One is around governance, which is, you know, as we're talking about service delivery, whether or not you are going to indulge in corruption. How do you think about livelihoods versus lockdowns, right? Is the cure worse than the disease? And how do you deal with security? But then there's some really interesting questions, you know, a second test in my mind around leadership. 21 out of the 49 leaders in sub-Saharan Africa are over 65. So they're uniquely vulnerable to this disease. One of the leaders, maybe the 22nd, the president of Gabon, is still recovering from a coma. And so we've already seen one leader, we presume, has died from COVID, Pierre Nkurunziza of Burundi. It's not confirmed, but that's the wide suspicion that he did die and is the first, you know, head of state to die from this disease. But if you look at, I've counted 21 ministers across the continent that have COVID-19. Three out of five of South Sudan's vice presidents have COVID-19. And so in some of these regimes that are highly personalized, centralized, when you are in isolation or recovering, it does sort of limit your ability to govern. And then just as Mona Nalante said, you know, what to do about elections that are coming up? We still have, in my region, eight more presidential elections that are on the books. And do you have an election and perhaps hasten the disease's spread, or do you delay it? And then what does that mean for democracy in your country? Some leaders so far have, I think, taken advantage of the disease to advance their own political agenda, you know, counting on low turnout so they could win a referendum to extend their term in office or to fill the legislature with their allies. Other countries have done a better job looking for consensus with the parties and institutions to delay it, as Ethiopia has, but the honeymoon only lasts so long. So even in Ethiopia, where that was a well-regarded decision initially, now there's a lot of pressure on the government to be transparent about their plans when it comes to this election.
To what extent have political opposition rallied around this? Because there are many African leaders, as you mentioned, who have sought to use COVID to advance what they were going to try to do anyway, which is to keep in power and to perhaps delay democratic reforms and democratic elections. Are opposition candidates really taking advantage of this, or did they not want to be seen politicizing the virus?
It really depends, right? 49 countries, 49 different scenarios. We are seeing a couple of opposition leaders, I think, working well with the government, even if they are political rivals, to address this emergency. There are other political opposition leaders that are calling their government to account. And we have an event at CSIS on Friday, the 17th, where we're having three opposition leaders from Tanzania, Zambia, and Zimbabwe to explain how they're addressing this crisis. And others are appealing to the international community to call out the government, or they're boycotting, which doesn't really help their case. So there's a real sort of diversity of experiences that are happening on the continent, but it's difficult to call out a government for health measures, right? Because now you're debating the science if they're if they're delayed the election. And if you're arguing against the election, you know, your opponent can cast you as arguing against democracy.
Yep. I want to make sure we don't leave behind the most populous country and the one I know you love, Nigeria. Is Nigeria a case where things are actually working out all right?
Nigeria, in every aspect, is always just like the United States, where you have this diversity of reactions. It's a federal state. You have many state-level governments that are doing phenomenal jobs, like in Lagos State, and you have other states like in Kano that has a huge count of unclaimed dead bodies, and they're denying that it's COVID, or other states like Cross River that says they have no COVID cases, which is almost certainly impossible. And the federal government sort of is doing a good job at points, relying on the institutions that they have, their version of the CDC. But I do think that the president, President Buhari, has really missed an opportunity to communicate more effectively to his constituents about this disease. He's not doing what President Ramaphosa of South Africa is doing, which is modeling wearing the mask and regularly briefing the public. He typically is more isolated as a leader, and he's lost his right-hand man. His chief of staff, Abiy Kiari, had passed away from COVID. And so I think he's a little unmoored right now, too.
Right. Let's spend some time on the national security implications of this. Mona, as usual, 2020 has seen no shortage of internal and international crises in the Middle East and North Africa, but let's focus on a few. First of all, tell me how COVID is impacting the counter-ISIS campaign in eastern Syria and northern Iraq, an issue you've been covering closely. How do you see this developing, and what are the danger signs here?
So I think already, you know, there had been some concerns prior to COVID raised by the Office of the Inspector General, who's, you know, provides assessments of Operation Inherent Resolve and how those operations are going. And already prior to the onset of the pandemic, there were concerns that ISIS was starting to regroup both in Syria, eastern Syria, and in Iraq. Once the pandemic arrives, that certainly had an impact on U.S. forces on the ground in both places. There were some drawdown of forces from Iraq. There's, you know, the need to lock down forces in response to the pandemic. So that certainly impacted the ability to undertake operations. Now, ISIS is also, you know, affected by the pandemic. And so early on, for example, they issued a travel ban and warned their members not to try to travel to Western Europe, which, of course, was already having a very, you know, significant impact right. from the pandemic. But what we've seen since, I think, are some concerning signs, both in terms of ISIS's ability to weave the pandemic into its narrative against the West and use it for propaganda purposes. But more importantly and more concerning, I think, a couple of developments. One is that ISIS has shown itself able to take advantage of local security forces either spending more of their time enforcing curfews mm-hmm. and less of their time tracking ISIS, you know, cells, or that these security forces themselves are on more of a lockdown. And so ISIS has taken advantage of that pause to mount more attacks. We've seen this in particular in parts of Iraq, where there have been some significant attacks, and also in eastern Syria, in the part of the East Syrian desert that is nominally under the Assad regime's control. And we've seen some significant ISIS attacks in that area. And then finally, I think something that sometimes doesn't get the attention it deserves is the fact that there are a number of ISIS detention centers as right. well as displacement camps in northeast Syria. Mm-hmm. Now, those are under the control of the Syrian Democratic Forces, a Kurdish-led, our local partners on the ground in northeast Syria. Already there were issues with the safety and security and stability mm-hmm. of those camps and detention sites prior to the pandemic. The pandemic simply, I think, deepened and heightened those concerns, added a layer of agitation to those both in the prisons and in the displacement camps. And we've seen, for example, the same prison in Hasakeh province in northeastern Syria have rioting take place amongst the prisoners, not once but twice. So that's another area that one needs to watch, particularly since ISIS has placed a premium on calling for prison breaks mm-hmm. as a way of boosting its recruitment.
Yeah, you dropped something in there that I don't want to let slide. You mentioned that ISIS has been using COVID-19 for propaganda purposes. How is this fitting into their narrative, and how receptive do you think populations in the region and beyond will be to it?
Well, I think they're of course talking about it as a curse from the West, as God's punishment on the West for its horrible behavior, et cetera. So they're using the pandemic and the impacts of the pandemic to sort of try and prove the point about how evil and horrible the West is. I think, frankly, though, more concerning, talking about what we spoke about earlier, which are these sort of the economic impacts. So those impacts are going to feed the kinds of grievances that organizations like ISIS feed off of. And so the extent to which we see sort of the post-COVID Middle East emerge with greater levels of disaffection, social disaffection, that there too, I think there's fertile ground for ISIS to use those conditions in its propaganda and for recruitment purposes.
Sure. Nilanthi, let's talk about the long-term national security implications in South Asia. India, for one, has been fascinating to watch in recent years as it has recalibrated its strategic positioning vis-a-vis China and the U.S. And of course, we've had the India-China border clashes lately. How do you see COVID-19 and its aftermath playing out in the subcontinent in terms of these regional strategic calculations?
I think that's really been a fascinating development to track, and it's really ongoing. As you mentioned, the India-China border clashes, that we're seeing the first fatalities at the border in decades. So it's pretty bad right now. And in terms of U.S. national interests, it's and sort of an unanticipated consequence of the India-China border clashes is to bring India even closer to the United States, which in my observation has really been a goal of U.S. strategy for over the past two decades, is to really bring India closer, just given the threat seen coming from China. So China doing what it's doing in terms of being increasingly assertive, that's only heightening India's threat perceptions. And India has a disposition toward autonomy, and this comes from its non-alignment posture during the Cold War and its larger foreign policy legacies. So it's very deliberately not a treaty ally of the United States, but it has been gradually becoming a closer strategic partner, a non-allied strategic partner to the United States, really over the last decade, and it's particularly under the Modi administration, so mostly the last 5 or 6 years. And now, actually, the U.S. Most recently in the past few years has given it the title of major defense partner. So we're seeing this increasing defense and strategic relationship between India and the U.S. develop, and those border clashes are only helping to bring India closer. But to bring it back to COVID, one development that I took note of is actually was very early on in March. You could see the State Department launching this grouping to sort of coordinate with diplomats in Indo-Pacific allies and partners. And India was one of those countries, part of that grouping. And you even saw Secretary Pompeo have a counterpart call with the Indian foreign minister or minister of external affairs, Jaishankar. So you definitely see the U.S. for its part sort of using COVID in terms of its messaging and the allies and partners it's reaching out to, particularly India.
And of course, whenever we talk about India's ties to the U.S. and the China dynamic, we have to talk about Pakistan. So how has the Pakistani government reacted to these developments, and how are they seeking to manage this post-COVID national security environment?
Well, as I mentioned, I think Imran Khan, there were just a lot of doubts about his commitment to an effective response. To Pakistan's credit, they did implement restrictions early, but it's just they were just perhaps a little too harsh than what the country could accommodate reasonably in terms of the economic consequences. So I think that's been difficult. And then, of course, U.S.-Pakistani relations have only been deteriorating as U.S.-India relations have only been increasing. So it's really, I think the U.S. has been really taking its relationship with India seriously and that effort to sort of bring it even closer. One thing that might be of interest, actually, is what the State Department has been doing in terms of its coordination group. It harkens back to what it did with the 2004 tsunami after that disaster struck, because essentially you saw the U.S., India, Japan, and Australia bonding together after this crisis and coordinating on the provision of of disaster relief. And that, interestingly, had a that non-traditional security event had a very traditional security outcome in that it laid the foundations for this quad relationship that is often discussed as being sort of a countering or containing China effort. And in 2007, it had sort of an apex in terms of a multilateral naval exercise, which China protested, and the quad kind of fell apart then. But if you fast forward about 10 years later, now the quad, it's actually been reconstituted in terms of their discussions. So some people are actually referring to the State Department's effort now on the COVID response with Indo-Pacific allies and partners as being the quad plus, because it's got four countries, the US, India, Japan, and Australia, plus a few other allies and partners like South Korea, New Zealand. Right. But it's been really fascinating to see how, again, this non-traditional security crisis with COVID and the response is actually having this traditional security outcome, because who's not part of that grouping? China is not part of that grouping, but U.S. allies and partners, like including Vietnam, these Indo-Pacific allies and partners are very clearly part of that. So there seems to be a messaging component coming out of the State Department with regard to this Quad Plus dialogue that's happening about COVID. So it has real implications for U.S. alliances and strategic partnerships.
There's definitely a messaging component there. Do you see it gaining more than that as a, in a sense, a forum to start moving forward on policy?
Well, I think that's kind of the big question. It's getting a lot of attention in South Asia, just due to India's participation and what's going now with the border clashes with China, as you mentioned. So there's just a lot of discussion. People are calling it the Quad Plus. So people want to see what's going to happen with this Quad version 2.0, given the one in the last decade fell apart. But now the discussion just between the four Quad countries, the US, India, Japan, and Australia, those are continuing. And now it's this Quad Plus effort. But again, you know, China is quite deliberately not part of this. So that's a big messaging aspect of this grouping.
Yeah. Judd, how might COVID-19 and its responses and outside actors' aid and other actions in Africa play out in a few key countries in the continent?
I'm just sitting here in awe of the Quad Plus format, which I hadn't heard of, but I think in sub-Saharan Africa, they would welcome that kind of multilateralism, because that's not what's happening on the continent. The Africans are really fed up, I think, with the way that great power competition has unfolded under COVID. And, you know, I have not seen in my career such sustained and public criticism of both the U.S. and China for a variety of reasons that are related to COVID and then COVID adjacent issues. So, you know, they understand that the disease came out of China. Many Africans have joined Australia in signing up for the World Health Assembly resolution looking at the origins of this disease. The Africans have been very frustrated with the racism that they have seen in Guangzhou. And so they've called, you know, Chinese leaders on the carpet around these issues. China has tried to rebound from that, particularly from Jack Ma, of Alibaba, who has been giving assistance across the continent in very dramatic ways. But that relationship has taken, at the minimum, a rhetorical hit and tonal hit from some of these other issues around COVID. And for the U.S., the Africans have rallied around Dr. Tedros of WHO, who was a former Ethiopian minister. They've been frustrated with the U.S.'s efforts to investigate the head of the African Development Bank. They have been very vocal about the George Floyd murder. And so, you know, that relationship is taking a hit. And I think that the Africans really have become the standard bearer for thinking about multilateralism. And there are so many actors that are giving aid to the continent, not just the U.S. and China, but Europe. But also India has given a lot of assistance, the Gulf states who have increased their engagement. So you've got a number of different countries that are active, but without coordination, I do think that it has been less effective. And to go back to an earlier point, I think it opens up for more opportunities for misuse, because there is no sort of transparency. I spent weeks trying to figure out who is given what to whom, and it was a journey.
So it seems to me that this is a real opportunity lost for American national security. Here, the relationship with China, which some people have focused on perhaps too much in terms of the continent. But here it is taking that rhetorical or tonal hit, as you mentioned, and the United States was not poised to take any strategic advantage of this.
No, the U.S. was really late to the game. I mean, I don't think the Africans would appreciate them taking, you know, that we're kind of in a glass house talking about racism in Guangzhou, given mm-hmm. where we are here in the United States. But right. it took the U.S. a very long time to even get their act together to talk about what they're doing. It took them till the 27th of March just to put out a fact sheet about their response to COVID. And, you know, we like in the U.S. to talk about how much money we're giving, which is substantial. I mean, which is really significant and really important. But the Chinese have been smarter about sort of what things sort of resonate in one's mind. So they're more mm-hmm. focused on how many PPEs, how many ventilators, how many masks. So I think it's a much more tangible, sticky kind of assistance. And the U.S. has attacked China. They've also attacked Cuba for their assistance. And then just actually today, this was not a smart move, the National Security Council applauded Taiwan for its assistance and partnership with Somaliland, which is a self-declared independent state, but it is not independent. And so the U.S. has now, I think, added insult to injury by weighing in on this issue on Taiwan's Somaliland, which the Africans are going to really blanch at.
Before we go, I'd like to hear from each of you about some other, if not wild cards, some other possible developments somewhere in your region that you think are being overlooked. I know, Mona, you've talked elsewhere about the danger of failed states and issues in the Middle East more widely coming up that people aren't really focused on helping out in the future for, because we're so obsessed with the present and trying to get ahead of the virus itself. But whether it's failed states or something else, what is it in the Middle East that you want to make sure that national security practitioners are keeping their eyes on for the future?
So I'd like to highlight two things. First is exactly that, failed states, and here in particular, Lebanon, which really is hurtling toward disaster in the near term. And there, I think a failed state in Lebanon will have enormous implications for the U.S. Already our allies, Israel and Jordan, I think are uncomfortable with the level of instability in the region. A failed state in Lebanon would really significantly increase that. But I also think it's important to understand, Lebanon hosts the largest number of refugees per capita in the world. The vast majority of them are Syrian.
Right.
And so a failed state in Lebanon really would have enormous negative implications for refugees there. It could also open up security vacuums that would be taken advantage of by ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other groups. And we could see Lebanese themselves, as you noted, but I think in a much more scary and ominous way, Lebanese who, out of desperation themselves, become, you know, refugees. And then lastly, I think it's important to underscore the looming humanitarian disasters. We talked about Yemen, which is one that is very notable, but I would also talk about Syria for a moment. Mm-hmm. In Syria, we've seen recently the first reported case of COVID in Idlib. This is the northwest governorate that is still under rebel control, or parts of it are. It is very densely populated with internally displaced people. They live in a very dense fashion. They don't have access to all the health facilities, et cetera, because of the regime's bombing of many of those hospitals. COVID in Idlib really will be a disaster. And we've already seen one reported case. And I think that the humanitarian situation in Syria is also going to bear very close watching.
All right. Judd, same question to you. What's the wild card here? What's the thing that we shouldn't take our eyes off of because of all of the other things going on?
I'm actually gonna flip it, David, and I'm going to talk about sort of the silver linings of COVID and how we shouldn't miss the policy opportunities here, right? Like, we need to look at this disease and what this disease and the response to it is telling us. First of all, the African Union's, the Africa CDC, which we invested in and helped set up after the Ebola crisis, has done a phenomenal job. And I think it's another testament to institutions. But we're seeing the greatest expansion of social welfare programming in sub-Saharan Africa since really the early independence period. We're seeing prison reform. How many times have I seen the State Department launch a human rights report that talks about prisons, and they're letting people out of prisons, these overcrowded prisons? We're seeing philanthropy on the continent in a major way. And we're seeing technology being used and adopted more frequently so people could sort of manage their lives. And so, you know, what I would argue for people to think about, since I spent a lot of time talking about the bad news, is how do we think about what's happened on the continent, the positive elements about responding to COVID, and not make them just band-aids, but actually concretize them, make them policy, and so that the continent can build back better.
Sounds good to me. Nilanthi, we'll give you the last word. What's something that we shouldn't take our eyes off of in South Asia as COVID plays out in any of these realms?
I think the economic impacts are really important, as are the potential for U.S. military operations, which seems to be really missing from the discussion that I've been observing. I would say with the economic impacts, as Judd mentioned, the U.S. has been giving a lot of important health assistance, and the money is significant, and I think it's very much welcome. But right, so has China. Some people are calling it China's mask diplomacy. But I think just in terms of the economic impacts that these countries throughout South Asia are facing, some are heavily indebted. They've requested money from the IMF, the World Bank, those types of packages. I think it suggests a real opportunity for the U.S., particularly with regard to the recently restructured U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, because that's what these countries need. Sri Lanka, for its part, it requested and got like $500 million to help address some of the deficits in its foreign exchange reserves. So I think there is potentially a real role here for the United States to kind of go beyond just sort of the PPE and the health assistance, which is, of course, very much welcome. But just the U.S., I think this could actually play a much more important role and have a longer lasting impacts. And then also just in terms of the potential for U.S. military response operations, like we have seen with previous disaster relief missions, like the 2004 tsunami. India, for its part, has already been deploying its military forces, including naval forces, all the way across the Indian Ocean to deliver relief. And Judd mentioned Europe and France, the U.S. very close allies, France and the U.K. They've also deployed their military forces for response operations. So I think just especially this framing of the Indo-Pacific allies and partners and this Quad Plus, it's really missing France and the U.K. despite their significant Indo-Pacific equities. It's really just been framed in terms of these mostly Pacific waters countries plus India and the UK, France, US relations are often framed in a transatlantic context. So I think this again poses a real opportunity to work with close allies like France and the UK on response to COVID, including potentially military response operations as the crisis continues to wreak havoc across South Asia.
I appreciate you highlighting that. And actually, I appreciate the time from all three of you. Thank you for joining us and giving us insight on these issues that we will continue to follow.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the podcast, rate the podcast, tweet and post about the podcast on social media, whatever you can do to help us spread the word. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Zachary Frank is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan, as always, performed our music. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.